is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. When you hear that sound, it means you are in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi, and I'm the producer and host of this podcast. Today, we are going to be talking with activist Umi Hagatani. She has traveled the country serving as an interpreter for Fukushima representatives who addressed American audiences, and she has a long history of being active in this movement. We'll be talking with her shortly. Today is Tuesday, May 22nd, 2012, 1 year and 72 days since the Fukushima tragedy began on March 11th of 2011. And here is the latest nuclear news. The big news in the United States is that Chairman Gregory Yasko, who has for 3 years had tenure as chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, announced on Monday that he would be stepping down and as soon as a successor is confirmed. Dr. Yasko is the longest-serving member of the five-member Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He had drawn sharp criticism for helping to end government consideration of a proposed nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain, a volcanic ridge about 100 miles from Las Vegas, and for assuming some emergency powers at the commission after the triple meltdown of Japan's Fukushima Daiichi reactors a year ago March. He sought to address some long-standing safety problems at America's nuclear power reactors, but with a background in nuclear physics and nuclear policy, but not the nuclear industry, Dr. Yasko was long viewed with skepticism and mistrust by some industry insiders. Until he is replaced, he will continue to direct the Regulatory Commission's ongoing work, overseeing, quote, protecting people and the environment. Dr. Yasko often found himself as the lone dissenting voice on important issues, including the speed with which American reactors should be reanalyzed and improved to incorporate the lessons learned from Fukushima and the extent to which post-Fukushima reforms should be completed before 4 new reactors, 2 in Georgia and 2 in South Carolina, should be licensed. He is known as the only nuclear regulatory commissioner who is concerned with safety issues. According to Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com, energy consulting firm, Southern California Edison's proposed solution for bringing the San Onofre nuclear power plant back online could make the issues at that troubled plant worse. It has been offline for more than 3 months because of excessive wear in steam generator tubes that carry radioactive water. SCE's Executive Vice President of External Relations, Stephen Pickett, said earlier this month that running the plant at reduced power could eliminate the excessive vibration. The company then proposed running at 50 to 80% capacity for a few months before taking the reactors offline for further inspections. But Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds said running at reduced power, quote, does not provide a remedy for the underlying structural problems and might actually create a resonant frequency within the steam generators at which some of the tubes will vibrate as bad or worse than they did originally. Gunderson said the only sure solution would be to replace the steam generators entirely, which he estimated would take 4 years and cost $800 million. Also regarding San Onofre, Senator Barbara Boxer of California has written to Southern California Edison and the NRC requesting documents related to the design changes in the steam generators. In a letter, Senator Boxer asked the NRC Chairman Yasko for documentation on how the federal agency reviewed generator modifications. At issue is whether SCE sidestepped any federal requirements by conducting extensive design changes. Senator Boxer requested a written summary describing the agency's plans to establish whether the steam generator replacement required a license amendment, as well as documents relating to the NRC's review of design changes and Edison's determination that a license amendment was not necessary. On Monday, Edison said in a statement that the NRC was fully informed that the replacement would be conducted under the same regulations as had been previously applied at other plants. In other words, this is a hot potato being passed back and forth, and thus far nobody is taking responsibility for the problems at San Onofre. Japanese tsunami debris is predicted to be the worst single pollution event ever to hit the west coast of North America and far exceeding the Exxon Valdez. This according to Senator Mark Begich, who's a Democrat in Alaska. During a Senate hearing, the senator asked the other senators present, what do you know about the radiation threat because of its concern to many in Alaska? He heard over and over again that there were some large sightings of debris. The sightings are growing rapidly, and his constituents are extremely concerned because they fear what the impact is going to be on their state. When he asked the panel repeatedly what the plan is to deal with tsunami debris, he was told there isn't any plan. Also in Alaska, hundreds of Alaska Airlines flight attendants have filed a formal complaint about uniforms they suspect may be causing their skin to rash and develop lesions and their hair to fall out. But based on the timing of the symptoms and the relation to similar symptoms in local marine life and polar bear populations, it appears as though radiation from Fukushima Daiichi may also be a potential culprit. This story was initially broken by KKing 5 News in Seattle, Washington. At least 280 flight attendants so far have been impacted by the mystery illness. According to accounts, those afflicted by the condition say they have developed persistently itchy skin, skin lesions, and hair loss. Alexander Higgins, who is a highly respected blogger on nuclear issues, recently connected the dots to discover a potential link to the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. After comparing the flight attendant symptoms to those reported on polar bears and marine life from the Northwest United States throughout the past year, the timing and correlation of the two proved highly suspect. As we get further information on this story, we will share it with you. In India, Kudankulam is gathering even more support from the world community for their protest against the nuclear power plant that is slated to go online there. British members of Parliament and members of the European Parliament have signed a letter from South Asian anti-nuclear groups to Indian Prime Minister Singh expressing deep concern over human rights and environmental issues around the controversial Kudankulam nuclear power plant. They argue that the plant violates the International Atomic Energy Agency's safety guidelines. The letter also demands the withdrawal of police and court cases against the anti-Kudankulam protesters, accusing security forces of intimidation and harassment. The signatories say that they fully appreciate India's energy needs, but argue that security considerations cannot be brushed aside. Quote, "We implore that alternative measures be investigated and invested in, rather than resorting to nuclear power plants in ecologically unsound circumstances," they said. Meanwhile, the pro-Kudankulam forces have come up with a novel program to put into place. Having exhausted all options to end the opposition to the Kudankulam nuclear power plant, the Indian government has decided to engage a team of psychiatrists from the National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences in Bangalore to take a peek into the protesters' minds and remove their fears. This team wants to evolve a method to engage those involved in the Kudankulam agitation and calm them down. For example, the fishing community is apprehensive about safety following the Fukushima disaster in Japan. There is also fear among villagers that once the reactor is set in motion, the condensed water released into the sea could affect marine life, jeopardizing the fishermen's livelihood. However, the mental health team members have planned to map out various exercises at the grassroots level to convince protesters that the nuclear power plant is safe and essential for the country. It sounds like the only thing that would work would be mass hypnosis, and this does qualify as the numbnuts of the week. Over in Japan, the overview for the reactors at Fukushima is not good. According to an analysis by the Japan Nuclear Energy Safety Organization, the possibility is that water inside the containment vessel of Reactor 1 may be only 15 inches deep, despite 6 tons of water per hour being injected into the reactor pressure vessel. The water level inside Reactor 2 has been measured by an actual survey to be about 23 inches deep. There is fear that the fuel debris, the corium, may not be completely submerged in the water, this especially for Unit 1. Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds has also weighed in on the units in Japan. He said that Unit 3 is a sleeper, as far as he's concerned, and has about half the nuclear fuel in its pool that Unit 4 does, but some of it is still quite hot. He says it has a hot enough quarter of a core that it could burn in the air. But unlike Unit 4, workers cannot enter Unit 3 for reinforcement work. So according to Arne, his concern is that the same problems on Unit 4 could occur on Unit 3, but it is not getting the same kind of attention. during the podcast, If You Love This Planet, which is Dr. Helen Caldicott's radio program, Arnie said, Unit 4 is weakened. I think about a magnitude 7.0 to 7.5 quake will knock that building to the ground. The fuel is still hot enough where it can begin to burn cesium and plutonium and create a pyrophoric fire, which is a fire that water cannot put out. This would likely result in the evacuation of Tokyo at the least and potentially contamination of the entire northern hemisphere. Arnie said, this is a now problem. This is not a let's wait until we get the cash flow from the Japanese government problem. He said, we're all in a situation of having to pray there's not an earthquake. And there's the other half of that, which is pray to God but row towards shore. And Tokyo is not really rowing towards shore right now. I think this simply proves that Arnie Gunderson is the Vermont Yankee that we still do want. Regarding the radioactive rubble in Japan, incinerating the radioactive sludge that is piled up at sewage facilities across eastern Japan and burying it after mixing it with cement could increase the risk of cesium seeping into the environment, according to scientists. A research team led by Hideo Yamazaki, a professor of environmental analysis at Kinki University, suggests the process may increase the risk of the transfer of radioactive cesium into the environment. The Tokyo Metropolitan Government is burying this material in landfill sites after mixing the ash with cement and water. Meanwhile, in Kyushu, Japan, which is the South Island of Japan, one that was relatively unaffected from radiation from Fukushima Daiichi, they have been receiving trucks of radioactive rubble in order to help in the disposal of debris left in Iwate and Miyagi prefectures. Kyushu remains unaffected from radiation compared to the eastern parts of Japan. It has been the place to receive the self-evacuated families from the affected area, as well as the place to grow uncontaminated food. Many residents are now afraid of unnecessary further radioactive contamination. From the incineration, about 30% vaporized radioactive materials will be diffused into the environment, and the resulting ash will be buried locally where rain eventually will wash it away and the radionuclides will go into the ocean. As of today, May 22nd, the people of Kokura City in Kyushu have been picketing and stopping the trucks that transport radioactive rubble from the northeast. After 12 hours of them standing in the way of the trucks in an active blockade, the people of Kokura City gathered in town hall to meet the Department of the Environment. There is a picture of them in this gathering that will be posted on the Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. Lined up in the front in this picture are concerned parents, each of them standing behind a stroller with a baby in it. The mayor did not show up to the meeting. And finally, this word from Fukushima, that 6 out of 10 Fukushima children who have been tested have been shown to have diabetes, which is one of the side effects of being exposed to the radiation. This according to the head of a Tokyo area medical clinic. He was expecting diabetes in children from Fukushima radiation, but not so many so soon. So, of course, the nuclear news is very rarely anything but depressing, but one of the things that's exciting is the chance to get to know some of the activists who are on the front line of the work that is being done. And our guest today is one such woman. Umi Hagatani is a Japanese in diaspora. This is her description of herself. A queer person of color, an interpreter, rape crisis counselor, cartoonist, an amplifier, former non-schooler, and a hardcore beach bum. She also has a great sense of humor. Umi is a survivor of the 1989 Musashi Kogyo University's nuclear accident. As a member of a Bay Area-based anti-nukes group, No Nukes Action Committee, she works to normalize conversations on education and struggles against radiation in order to end interpersonal, community, and state violence. Umi recently visited San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station in Southern California and the Hanford site in Washington State to support local anti-nuclear struggles. Umi, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hello. Thank you so much, Libby, for having me, and thank you for the hot seat, you know, giving the hot seat weekly. It's so empowering all the time, you know, always.
Thank you very much. Well, let's get started with something I had never heard about before, the 1989 Musashi Kogyo University nuclear accident. What was that, and how were you impacted by it?
So this happened in the borderland of the Kanagawa Prefecture, in the borderland of Kawasaki City and the Yokohama, and I think this was relatively minor in the media, so it doesn't show up. And if you see the Wikipedia of Japanese version, then you can see it, but English version, I don't think there is any information. And there's this Musashi Kogyo University is this like a researchers institute, and that is now becoming Toritsu University, so it doesn't exist anymore because of the accident, numerous accidents. And in 1989, in this research reactor, there is a leakage of the cooling water, and which was traumatized by local researchers and investigators. So I was 8 at the time, but we rushed to the gate of the institution, and then we asked for the transparency of the information, and they really didn't ever come up.
So you were protesting it almost immediately when the accident was still happening or had just passed.
It just passed. So, well, we don't know yet. You know, we didn't know back then that it was happening or not, but we were just like deranged folks because it was right after the Chernobyl. And, you know, after the Chernobyl, Tokyo people, especially like the parents who were giving food from Italy, for example, you know, eating spaghetti and yogurt from like Eastern Europe, and then they were really concerned about their kids. So we rushed in, like, regardless of the situation, because we were not told about the situation. Somebody investigated. So we just had numerous protests locally.
As has been proven, the first word that comes out after any nuclear accident is always a diminution of whatever the effects are, if not outright lies. So it's not surprising that you didn't have the truth then. Was that when you became involved in the anti-nuclear movement, even though you were only 8 years old at the time?
Well, I would say I wasn't very sure if I were involved, but I educated myself, and it was a good time for us. Before Fukushima and before 1999 Tokai Village accident in Ibaraki, there were more literature for kids. Like Chernobyl was enough for us. There is a, you know, great culture of anti-nukes in Japan back then. So people have problematized a lot about like what happened in Three Mile Island, for example. But it was only after Chernobyl that we learned about Three Mile Island. So we became very suspectful and suspicious about this. And as a kid, I was exposed a lot. And I also went to the biggest protest in Tokyo at that time, in 1987, and that was like 20,000 people gathered for the anti-nukes cause.
Would that we could get crowds that large here in the United States. Maybe we will. We'll keep working towards it.
Sure, and we had that in New York, you know, after the 3 Mile, or like we had evacuation, for example. So I think the evacuation is a way, and I think it's the most powerful way of protesting, although maybe people around the people who evacuated don't know what is the cause. So I wouldn't just say the number is important, but it's more about the awareness.
So where were you when Fukushima happened?
Oh, I was in the Bay Area. I was in Oakland.
And how did you get the information, and what was your immediate response when you were finding out about it?
It was very funny because 2 days ago on March 9th, we heard about the Miyagi earthquake, which was relatively minor, which also fucked Onagawa reactor in Miyagi. But I heard about that 2 days ago before March 11th, and I freaked out. So I was freaking out for 2 days, and then March 11th happened. There was like my mother and all the people whom I know in the metropolitan area became, you know, evacuees. Like they became temporal refugees, and I was very, very upset about that. And
when you say the metropolitan area, are you talking about of Tokyo?
Tokyo, yes.
Okay.
Because my mother is working in Tokyo, so she of course had the immediate impact of the earthquakes. And I also had my coworkers back then in Miyagi. Unfortunately, all of them have died because of the accident. Not the accident, but the disaster. So
wait a minute. These people have died as a result of the Fukushima disaster?
It's Miyagi earthquakes. I'm sorry. and the tsunamis.
They were killed by the tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
so
I'm so sorry to hear that.
To do with the, no, well, but, you know, we move on. So, yeah, so that happened. And, you know, I felt very sick about this because what initially I was listening to the news carefully, and my friends who have been activists, not only like, you know, environmental activists, but the people who are aware have started talking about the, you know, forthcoming Fukushima accident. And also there are lots of military people among my friends, or, you know, people who are from the U.S., people who are from Japanese self-defense army, and also their immigrant friends who did not understand English. So through the Facebook, I really, like, sensed that what's going to come about Fukushima. So I was really feeling sick. And after that, you know, after I heard the accident, I got totally sick, and I wasn't able to eat anything for, like, a month. It was pretty shocking because basically whenever I started talking to friends from here, it was sucked into the sentiment of like, oh, you're Japanese, so you must be sad. There's no consideration about my immigrant friends in Japan, or there's no consideration about potential or like ongoing contamination in, you know, the Pacific, the whole Pacific.
So they were concentrating on the effects of the earthquake as opposed to looking at the ongoing disaster that was triggered by the earthquake and tsunami.
Exactly. Even New York Times said, like, oh, resilient Japanese people keep maintaining, which is not true from what I know from people's lives. People are immediately silenced because there is more push to the economical recovery. And as we know, during the September 11th, a lot of toxic materials came out of the World Trade Center and this fallout, but nobody talked about it. And people really basically focused on the resilientness of New Yorkers. So I noticed the similarities, and that really also brought me up the issues of, like, you know, racism, environmental racism, also ethnocentrism that Japan has been doing, and also, like, sexism. There's, like, a lot of understanding of, you know, like, what is Japanese woman, all that kind of things, you know. So I don't know, I can't really say, put in words, but
You're doing a great job. What it sounds like is that the media was playing off a stereotype of a submissive culture and obedient culture and one that would rally, as opposed to addressing the problems that people needed to be protecting themselves from. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I think that's very accurate. So I saw, like, oh, well, there's no differences between the violence that was happening to me on the day-to-day basis, you know, before March 11th and after the March 11th. So I thought, oh, this is the time and this is the calling that I should raise awareness. And also, most of my friends from here said, like, oh, don't you worry about it. They Googled for 5 minutes and told me, nobody died of Three Mile Island. Why do you worry about your mother? People who evacuated from Chernobyl actually died immediately after, sooner than the people who remain in Chernobyl.
Right, and one of the reasons that there's deniability at Three Mile Island, where I was 1 mile away when it happened and didn't evacuate till the third day, but one of the reasons that there's no data to prove that there were illnesses that resulted is that no raw data was ever collected. So it gives them deniability in the long run.
Exactly. And I know that my quality of life belongs to me. So it is not the number of the people. So I immediately felt that my mother's village in Ibaraki, when I think about each person's face, I thought, oh, these people are calculated as numbers, not as living animals, as human beings. These people's lives are so, like, not valuable very much because they have thick accents from the, you know, north area, and because they're farmers, nobody cares. So I felt a shock. This was a soul shock for me.
So how did you become involved with No Nukes Action Committee? Were you already involved with them, or this only happened after Fukushima?
After Fukushima, I went to the, you know, anti-war protest on April 10th after I recovered from the shock, initial shock. And then I went to several actions in Diablo Canyon, or I went to, like, public hearing, and I still didn't know how to juggle my personal experience as somebody from outside of Fukushima, and also I tried to find out the connection between what is going on in California and what can we do. Then I met really, really several really rigorous activists from here. Anti-NUKES activists from here are like, you know, the people who have been working on labor issues, namely Husako DeAngelis and Steve Seltzer. So they and I held the first action in front of the Japan's Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco. And that was initially May 7th. It's a year from now, a year ago. So since then, we started.
So in other words, the group came, it was formed after Fukushima.
Yes, exactly.
So how did you become involved with being the interpreter for so many representatives from Japan who have come over to address us in conferences? I heard the first time I ever saw you was at a conference up in San Francisco at a school there. And since then, I've seen you in multiple circumstances with different people being their voice in English for what it is they have to say.
I think one of the reasons is that there aren't many anti-NUKES interpreters. I don't know how to count. But anyways, so the chances are like really, really, you know, fewer for us compared to people from like other cities. Like, for example, New York have more network and more people, speakers coming in, and there are like 40,000 people who have like, you know, skills to interpret. But I really don't know so many other Japanese people in California who are willing to contribute their time to translation or interpretation, which is not true. But I thought, you know, at the time I didn't know about that. So I thought like, oh yeah, I should be doing this. And I just happened to be. I should say I just happened to be, because I had a lot of time in my hands. And I also didn't know how to help out. And I also didn't agree with the former social movement that separated two world of like Japanese speakers and English speakers or any other language speakers. I really wanted to see something happen simultaneously, and I thought I could be the force to do that. And No NUKES Action held the educational conference, or New Creek, California was formed in August, and I just happened to be, you know, I just happened to have time to do that.
And you definitely have been a bridge between the cultures. So I'm wondering, how effective do the people you've been interpreting for feel that they have been in addressing their concerns with an American audience? Do they feel that we are receptive? Do they feel that it is making any difference, or it has made any difference?
Well, these two delegates from Miyagi and Fukushima came about because of the Steve Seltzer and Torii Kazumi's movie, Fukushima Never Again. They met the friends and affiliations of the delegates, and then we wrote letters and explained like how California history is the whole nuclear power's history, so they should come over. So these like rigorous parents who have been investigating and, you know, doing actions on their own came about. And basically what they did was two things. I think what they protested was like, don't trust our governments. They're not doing very good jobs. And the second thing is that we should be able to see that we're not supposed to see, which is one of the proposals that was given to the community of the San Onofre area, was to start monitoring. And they and I think, the delegates and I think, that it really was successful. It is successful because by March 22nd, Residents Organized for a Safe Environment started monitoring team. They formed monitoring team in their 50 miles radius of San Onofre, and they also said out loud in the letter to the NRC about like, this is not about not in our backyard issues, but we have to be really, really have to hold the NRC to be accountable. And that broke down, you know, Gregory Yatsko on the April 6th to the private meeting with the local activists of the San Onofre, and we're very happy about this.
Well, there's been a tremendous amount of progress being done at San Onofre, and the momentum is building to shut down that plant. And truly, by being the interpreter for these representatives from Japan, you have helped add their voice to our voices about the seriousness of the issue and the need to address it. Now, I'm wondering what ongoing concerns there are in Japan that we might be able to give some support to being based here in the United States?
I think, you know, the ongoing propaganda of supporting Tohoku area, the northeast area of Fukushima, by burning rubbles, contaminated rubbles, is such a myth, and it's such a wrong thing to do for Japan. Because it's really contaminated. It's just spreading contamination all over Japan and all over to the Pacific. And also Japan is still proposing Mongolia to take over our rubbles or Pagan Islands in the Pacific. So what we can do from here, from the U.S., is to learn about, like, what Japan is doing. Of course, Japan has stopped, like, 50, you know, commercial reactors, excluding the four that are so damaged in Fukushima, but it's temporarily. And now in Oi nuclear reactor, they're trying to restart it. And this propaganda, this push to restart the reactor is, you know, really tremendous. And if people are fighting, and 54% of Japan's population are against it, but it is completely ignored. So if we can inform about this to each other, that'll be good. And also eat and support the Northeast vegetables. It's so wrong. This is another thing that Japan's government is doing. They're fake labeling. Japan's government is fake labeling veggies. And as you know, we're trying to sell it to places in, you know, suffering in hunger in North African countries. Or like we fake label it and sell it to Philippines. And this is like total imperialism and total, you know, invasion. And we have day-to-day questions about, oh, that sounds so bad, but can we eat sushi still? You know, that's our question. I hear that all the time, but we should stop asking this. And whenever we hear this question of can we still eat sushi, we should say no.
Because I stopped eating sushi on March 11th of last year.
Good. You know, like, since last year, like, people have been talking about it, and Japan has been selling to its own people that any fish is from the Pacific. It's so blur, and it's lying to its own people. So the small things that you can do is, like, stop Facebooking Japanese food, the pictures of it, and don't say you enjoyed it. Enjoy it privately, because the personal behavior really demonstrates government's propaganda at this point right now. So if you upload sushi photo or if you go to the beach, enjoy yourself, you're actually exposing yourself to the radiation. But not only that, like, you are really demonstrating, telling other people, it's safe enough for me, so take your risk. We don't have to care about it. It's safe. So we have to be really careful about that.
And I think you make a really good point about using social media as a means of getting honest information out. Because I get many posts from you and from others that are in Japanese. I can't read them, but I know that they aren't saying, gee, sushi is great for you, you know, and let's all buy Fukushima vegetables. They're definitely the opposite to that. So I think another thing that listeners might be able to do is, when you come across the information that are the honest warnings, pass them on. This is the only stream of information that's going to be honest and true to what's going on, because the last thing we want to do is go, oh, this is wonderful behavior, and then sometime down the line they say, you know, you really shouldn't have been acting in that way back then, because that was really dangerous behavior. But if we don't know the truth, we can't operate from it. And if we're believing the lies and aren't seeking out the honest information, we can be trapped into really damaging ourselves, and so can the people of Japan who are being so propagandized at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a rape crisis counselor, I'm certified by California, so I can say that there's no differences between nuclear issues and any other issues. Like, if anybody's into, like, anti-fracking, or if anybody's into advocating, you know, the survivors of rape crisis counseling, all we need is community education. remember like when HIV and AIDS were started, like talked about by people, people almost pretended that mm-hmm. it's nothing to do with us, like homophobic attitude, for example. Or like
right, anytime it's bad information, it's very difficult for mm-hmm. people to come to the fore about it. And I certainly have beliefs that I'm an abuse survivor myself, so that any kind of abuse takes the same form, be it the abuse that is coming to us by the bullies in the commercial nuclear energy industry, or from individual perpetrators who happen to be within our own lives. They take much mm-hmm. the same profile of actions together.
Mm-hmm. If we see the violence, we should stop letting violence go through our body, or like we shouldn't speak of violence, or we should choose not to use the violence. So I think that's the common ground that we can find out. So you don't have to know about nuclides, or you don't have to know about the half-life, not so much, but we have to know that this is on the, like, this is really attacking our daily life,
mm-hmm.
and we can inform about it, and we can fight.
Right. So, Omi, in about the 30 seconds that we have left for this, what
mm-hmm.
final action would you like us to take, thought would you like us to hold, or just fill in the blank for that, whatever you'd like to say.
Okay. So one of the community education that we're trying to do is that No Nukes Action, together with the artist, the Doug Minkler, who have been making a lot of social justice political posters, are going to hold an action, printmaking performance at the Oakland Museum from 2 p.m. on June 9th. And you can find about it from our website. And I want you to come over with a blank sheet of paper, or if you want to pass out flyers, feel free. It's your venue. So come over and meet with us.
So, Omi, send me that information, and I will definitely post it on the Nuclear Hot Seat website, and I will use social media and get the information out. Because every communications tool that we have at our disposal, we're not NBC, we're not CNN, but we can still reach out and one by one get the true information out and let people know what the dangers are and what they can do to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Omi. This has been a lovely conversation, and I wish you every success in your future work with No Nukes Action Committee and all the other groups with which you are involved.
Thank you so much. I hope the same to you and everybody who's listening to this.
Thank you. Omi Hagitani is a Japanese anti-nuclear activist. She's based in the Bay Area, and she works with No Nukes Action Committee, and just seems to be everywhere that there are concerns by the Japanese people dealing with nuclear energy. Thank you so much, Omi.
Thank you.
So I always like to include a holistic healing tip, one of those. Anyway, do you eat an apple a day? That saying takes on more meaning now that we've found out that apple pectin is effective in getting radiation out of the body, though it's doubtful that a single apple will have significant impact. But by increasing your apple pectin intake, you can protect yourself from radionuclides. The National Institute of Health research confirms that apple pectin reduced radioactive cesium in children who were exposed to radiation at Chernobyl. It significantly removes radioactive strontium-90, heavy metals, and cesium-137 to protect you against radiation exposure. So, yes, go ahead, eat your apples, but in your smoothie in the morning, add a big tablespoon or two of apple pectin along with bentonite clay and any of the sea vegetables that you may be using and any of the other green foods such as spirulina. Use that to help detoxify your body every morning. You will be better in the long run. Now, here's an unexpected activist opportunity. We don't normally think of giving praise to people we may perceive as our enemies, but NRC Chairman Gregory Yasko deserves our acknowledgement. He'll probably never be anti-nuke, but he was our only voice for safety on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And soon he will no longer be in that position. Now, years ago, I read a wonderful book called Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor. It was about her experience training dolphins. And she quickly discovered that she couldn't overpower them. And because it was their environment, water, not air, which she needed, there was no way that she could use force with them. So what she learned was to reinforce good behavior and ignore bad behavior. And she explained how to use that on animals and people, including her mother-in-law. So we can do the same thing here. Let's support the good part of what Chairman Yasko represented. If you want to send him an email, you can do so at chairman@nrc.gov. Be sure to urge him to take his remaining time to make even stronger statements about the need for nuclear safety. He no longer has to protect his position at the NRC, so now would be the time for him to speak out without reservation. And you can help encourage him to do that. And here's the final thought for the day. When one is an activist, it's easy to get caught up in the intensity of this work and get dragged down by it. Now, I'll admit, there are times when I wish I didn't even know what an atom was, let alone how they have been raped and perverted into the life-destroying, future-destroying isotopes that result from all aspects of the nuclear industry. It's a downer, I'll admit. So what I have found, and what other activists I know do, is take ourselves to nature several times a week. Take a hike, go to the beach, ride a horse or just pet one, touch Earth, give thanks for this beautiful planet. And if you feel so inclined to, in a safe way, let your emotions out. Rage, fear, anger, despair. Give it a voice. Give it over to something bigger and greater than yourself. I know that when I let myself do this, I come back refreshed, strengthened, and ready to go another round or 10 with the nuclear industry. So I urge you to find balance that will let you to continue through the tough times. Remember, we need every last one of you to turn the nuclear insanity around before it's too late. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 22nd, 2012. You can find us syndicated to airprogressive.org, streaming web radio, posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog, which is where our archives are located. You can find us on the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat page and the Nuclear Hot Seat group page, and also on iTunes Podcast, where you can subscribe and get each week's podcast in your inbox. If you go to our new Facebook site and click on like, it will help us show up in the Google algorithm. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep. Be safe, be well, and I will speak with you again next week.